Welcome to Photodump.
This is a podcast by and for working photographers
with
Ren
and Jen.
All right, before we start, we have some really exciting news.
Yeah, we were invited to do a panel on the photography industry by our friend Monica Wang, who owns the beautiful Reverie. They are a studio and event space here in LA, and we decided to make that a live recording of Photo Dump.
We'll be talking about all things photo industry and how we got started, how the podcast got started. But the thing that I'm most excited about is we're going to do an audience Q&A at the end of everything. That'll be really fun. If you're in LA, we would really, really love to see you. It'll be on September 28th at 7 p.m. and the studio is located in Chinatown.
Our panel will be moderated by the talented photographer and creative director, Audrey Ma.
She's amazing. We're both really big fans of her work.
We're excited to have this conversation together and record it and share it with all of you guys. And if you're in LA, come see us.
All of the proceeds from the ticket sales are going directly to Lost Photos Project, which is an LA-based nonprofit that elevate creative voices of teenage girls and gender expansive youth. And they offer photography workshops and mentoring. And they're just a really awesome program. So we're really excited that all of the proceeds are heading in their direction.
You can find a link to buy tickets in our show notes or on Instagram.
And we think it's going to be all around a good time.
Come say hi. Let's get into the episode now.
Let's do it. All right. AMA.
AMA. So a bunch of you commented on a post or DM'd us about a few questions, and we thought we would just do like a quick fire AMA.
I think it's worth a note that before we answer any of these questions, these are just our personal experiences, and there's no right way or wrong way or one way to do anything. And so our feedback is just from our own experiences.
Yep. Someone asked about how we know each other. I feel like we talked about this before, but maybe not in super detail.
We were virtual pen pals.
Virtual pen pals slash my therapist, my work therapist.
On Slack.
On Slack. Ren and I met through a company we both used to work for, or their different offices, and there was multiple photographers for each office. And Ren was in New York and I was in LA. And we just bonded over
corporate life.
Corporate all call meetings.
Yeah, it was a food delivery company, and we were each hired in our own cities to lead the food photography departments. We were a team of one.
We were hired to lead ourselves.
We were hired to lead when you said ourselves. That, I
was like, the department. The department was us. We were the photographer, the stylist, the prop stylist. We made props. I don't know how much stuff you did because you're in New York, and I felt like it was harder for you to like.
Yeah, I had to hire people to do it.
Yeah.
I think I hired someone to make the first three surfaces for me. Yeah, I couldn't make anything in my apartment.
I like went to Home Depot and like got surfaces and yeah, painted surfaces, got some surfaces made, prop shopping. Yeah, so that's how we know each other. And then Ren quit.
Couldn't handle the full time.
And then reoccurring. I got laid off not too long after, but then we were both hired back on as freelancers.
Well, I convinced the New York department to hire me as a freelancer, mainly because I wanted the freedom of freelancing, but I was freaked out about not having regular income. And so I did this whole pitch to them about why it was better for them to have me part-time as a freelancer. And then it went across the board. I think you were next and was the Seattle.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone ended up going freelance.
I didn't ask to go freelance because I was actually trying to stay on salary as long as I could because I was also trying to buy a house. And it was really hard because I had freelance income, but I think they wanted 3 years wherever my lender was. Like they wanted 3 years of freelance income. And I had like 2 years of freelance income. And it didn't matter if I was just like 1 year on salary. That was better than the freelance income. Anyways, complicated, but it was fine because I got laid off and then they literally hired me back the next day.
But it was the kick that I think we both needed to fully venture out into freelance world. And that was the last we ever worked on salary, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before that, I guess I was doing design full time as salary. But then were you doing
editing? What was I doing?
Were you at the candy shop?
I was at a candy shop. That's right. Well, before that, I worked in post-production and then in commercials, like for on TV. So broadcast. And then I got super burnt out. And I didn't even really like post-production, but it was the most stable job I could think of pursuing after film school, because loans. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just not for me. And so I was kind of bumming around for a while trying to figure out what exactly I wanted to do. And then when I settled on photography, I assisted some people and then got a very entry-level job shooting for a famous candy store in New York, like doing all of their in-house photography.
That's fun.
Also as a freelancer, but really I was full-time.
Like a permalancer.
But I was just one day shy of getting benefits, basically. No. So. But anyway, this gig ended for us, but our friendship went on to become bigger and better. And then we were living on opposite coasts. It wasn't until I moved to LA that our friendship really solidified into a real in-person.
Yes. And even now, though, I feel like, I mean, we see each other in person, but we literally text every day.
Yeah.
So
so we're still kind of virtual pen pals slash sometimes in person.
Yeah.
Buds.
Segueing, some other questions we got were about sourcing props. And since mm-hmm. we talked about the other company we work for and like making props, I mean, I think now you and I both work with stylists, but people asked about sourcing props, making props, and then also how to find and collaborate with prop stylists. So I feel like that could segue into each other.
Yeah. Well, as far as surfaces go, if you are not wanting to rent them, you could make them yourself. That's what you were doing for a really long time, making your own beautiful surfaces. I tried a little bit, but I just didn't have the artistic touch.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of work and a lot of trial and error to make your own props. There's definitely online sources where you can purchase surfaces and or even like a lower end, you know, vinyl surfaces that look like certain things.
When I was living in New York, I did ceramics for a really long time. And so when I got into photography, I started making my own ceramics specifically for shooting.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, things like photograph differently. So that's another way you could just become a potter.
Yes, make your own. I feel like looking at any of the big box stores, especially when you start out, like I think World Market has like great things that are pretty affordable that aren't shiny, you know. So I guess that would be props and surfaces at a glance. And then how to find and collaborate with food and prop stylists.
Well, before we get into that, I feel like having your own prop closet is great if you're playing around and you're learning how to shoot and test and do all that. But I feel like at a certain point, I don't know how much money I personally would recommend investing in it, because you're really trying to advance in photography, and prop styling is a very different thing that requires a different kind of investment and different kinds of time.
Totally.
So I would encourage meeting other stylists.
Yeah. And no, testing. Definitely. Yeah. I think specifically the people who are asking about props, I think in the beginning, you haven't met anybody yet, and you're just trying to do something on your own. You could totally just run out and get.
Right.
And also there are certain clients where you don't have the budget, but maybe you're trying to push them a little bit more and you can't afford another person, but maybe you want to. I think there was a couple of jobs that I did in the very beginning where it was just I brought my own things, because even though I was doing this job at a lower budget, I really wanted to also use that opportunity to like push the photography in a different way. And so that's why I did it. It's not something I would definitely like recommend all the time.
But if it's something that's really fun for you,
yeah,
then definitely.
It's fun for you. I mean, I also really enjoy some of the styling part of it too. So.
Oh, there's a lot of, not a lot, but there's some great prop houses that people can rent from,
yeah,
which are PropLink.
Yeah, I think it depends on where you live, but in LA.
Oh, in LA, sorry, yes.
In LA, PropLink, Surface Library.
Which is also connected to Historic Hudson Studios. So if you're shooting at either PropLink or Historic Hudson, you can rent unlimited props and surfaces.
I think there's a limit on how many you can take out at once while you're shooting at the space, but that's really nice to know if you, you know,
if you have to style yourself or whatever.
If you have to style yourself, you have resources there.
Oh, also Plated and Patina, good prop rental What are some other ones? I know Amy
Modernica.
Chin. Modernica. Oh, yes. Modernica for furniture, for sure. Yeah, for
furniture. Amy Chin has one. I think it's like mini. It's like a mini super mini.
Oh, that's
mini
cute.
Super studio. Yeah.
I think that's pretty much it. Yeah.
There's only others if you're looking for bigger things or more specific. We do a lot of tabletop stuff.
You know,
stuff, so.
To shout out, there's a prop stylist that I'm friends with, Bailey, mm-hmm. and she just posted a reel a week or two ago that goes through her favorite prop houses in LA.
Yeah.
So maybe we could link to that. Great. There's so, a next part.
Well, then
question.
Just like how to find and collaborate with props and food stylists, etc.
When I was first starting out, because I was helping other photographers either as an assistant or as a tech, I would meet other assistant stylists on set. And starting out, I feel like those are the best people to test with because they are also trying to level up in their careers. And I find that assistants are always the most eager to test. So if you're first starting out and you're working on other people's sets, I would make friends with the other assistants on those sets.
In addition to that, if you're not yet there yet, you're not on set with other people, you could just really Google or yeah. like look through Instagram. And, you know, not everyone is going to be at a place and point where they're going to want to test, or they already have a lot of people that they are trying to test with. But I think it's always great to make an introduction, even if there's some stylists that you like and they're not interested. Maybe they can recommend their assistants. Things like that. It's just a lot of through word of mouth. You know, you can ask other friends, like, who do you work with?
And I don't know if this is a nice thing to say, but realistically, if you are an entry level anything, then the super like professional level photographer, stylist, whoever probably won't make time to test with you, which is there's nothing wrong with where you are. It's just everyone needs to get something out of it equally. And so I think that's something good to keep in mind, the people that you're reaching out to.
Yeah, I guess just to not feel disappointed when not all of them come running and saying yes. Also, a lot of stylists are really busy. And even if they want to test with you, it's just sometimes it's all about scheduling, which I think we talked about in our testing episodes. So.
Timing too. I had a few stylists reach out to me that I'm actually really interested in testing with, but I'm just a little burnt out on testing. I did a lot of testing at the beginning of the year and I kind of am just needing a little break from testing. So it really is just all about timing. There's no rush to test. It is sure is fun.
Mm-hmm, it is fun.
And check out our testing episode.
I think a lot of people asked about, you know, they really liked our red flags episode and how do you get from only getting red flag clients to getting bigger clients.
Yeah.
And I mean, I really think a lot of that's just over time.
Yeah. Experience.
And then marketing yourself to the right kinds of people.
Yeah.
But that's also over time.
I think there's certain things that you just can't avoid. And the only way to learn those lessons is to go through them. And you kind of have to go through those hard lessons to know what you will and will not put up with. And so if you are getting red flags that you want to avoid, then just say no to that kind of work. That's really the only way. It's impossible to know how everything will pan out. And you kind of have to go through it to learn from it.
I think I kind of want to say that person that wrote in seemed like they had a lot of experience because they understood treatments and things like that. So maybe it's also just like a marketing thing too.
Yeah.
Like learning, maybe you're not marketing to the right people.
Could be.
To the clients, you know.
But also if you're sensing a red flag, then I think it's on you to nip it in the bud. I still get a ton of red flag inquiries and clients. It's just now I know what to speak up about, what to push back on. Usually it's good and they're receptive. And if they're not into it, then great, crisis averted. I probably won't work with them.
I think also it's like as you shoot more, it's understanding where you draw the line and when you're willing to walk away and not walk away. I think in the beginning,
it's harder to walk away to a lot
of things. All right. So that was red flags and low budget clients.
Well, specifically low budget clients. I think this is going to sound really woo woo, but I think what you put out into the universe, it'll come back. And there's definitely a certain point in your career where I think you and I both did this, where we just stopped saying yes to certain budgets because we wanted to make room for the bigger budgets. And again, that kind of sounds a little bit woo-woo, but I feel like closing a chapter opens you up to like setting an intention and working towards the kind of budgets that you do want to work on. I'm not saying that you have to say no to every single low budget, but I do think there comes a point where you have to make a decision about what kinds of shoots you want to take on.
You just reminded me about assisting. Yeah. You know, there's a few photographers who assist all the time, and that's great if that's all they would like to do. But there's definitely assistants that I know that want to be pursuing more photography jobs. And that's a situation where they're getting inquiries, but the client inquiries are low budget, but they're also getting so many assisting inquiries where it's hard to, you know, obviously you're making money. So it seems like it's better to be making money, but then at a certain point you have to say no to those assisting jobs so that you can move on to take on some of that maybe lower budget jobs that will just help you build your, you know, client base and photography if you're not testing all the time.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of it is just taking a leap at a certain point and kind of just committing to what you want to do.
Yep. Let's see what else. Okay, so someone asked, is doing net 30 still the norm?
I think yes, but with caveats.
I think it depends. I guess, Ren, you can tell your scenario.
So it really depends. For me, I feel very lucky in the sense that, well, first of all, even before I had an agent, I was a really strict net 30 where I had it in my terms. And I'm not saying that everyone honored that, but I always followed up within 30 days and usually got paid pretty quickly once I followed up if I had to. So I feel like I've been a net 30 my entire career. And now that I have an agent who handles all of the billing, it seems like not everyone has this experience, but she's really good at getting paid on time. So we've only had a few clients that missed the mark. And it was always something that was kind of a weird issue that was happening on the back end. Like, it had nothing to do with the fact that, oh, we misunderstood and they're actually a net 60 or a net 90. There was just something like some sort of miscommunication that always got sorted out. But I feel like every now and then you work with clients that in their terms, they're not net 30. And then in that case, Jennifer, you can talk about.
I think same scenario with Ren is that I've always had net 30. You know, also we're saying net 30 as in this is a remaining
balance
minus the expenses. So like
net 30 starts from when you send an invoice, not when you finish a job.
Yeah. So usually, you know, for a lot of our jobs now, we're always getting 100% of the expenses up front. Even on some of the smaller jobs that I'm doing, I'm asking that. And you should too, everybody. Doesn't matter what point of photography you are.
Because, can I interject for 1 second? Even if you are not being paid net 30, say you're being paid net 90, you still have to pay your crew within 30 days. So you should have an advance that covers that because your crew should not be waiting until the day you get paid. Your crew should be paid for their service in a timely manner.
Right. In most scenarios, it's net 30 always, but I have worked with specific editorial brands that are relatively large and also really big corporate companies, places you shop all the time that don't have net 30. Sometimes it's because it's through a production company and then the production they don't sign our contract. The client, they won't sign our contract.
Oh, gotcha.
And we have to sign their contract.
And then it's spelled out in their contract.
And so, and that's why. So I would say even though we are a net 30 and some jobs are a net 30, I would say average is like probably 16 and 90, unfortunately. But I will have to say like all the expenses are paid up front. So it's never a situation where I have to front money for a job. So I think it really just depends on the case and scenario, but I do think if it's your own invoice, you should always be putting at least net 30.
Yeah, or your own contract.
For your own stuff. And actually, on some of the contracts that I have, like sometimes I don't necessarily invoice until I deliver everything. I put like an upfront for expenses and then I invoice once it's delivered. And once it's delivered, I have a 15-day net 15. I think
for certain clients.
For certain clients, right. They have everything in hand, there's no reason why I should be waiting 30 days.
I agree.
How I feel. But I mean,
or 45
or 90 or 60. I feel like a lot of people don't like that, and a lot of people complain about it, but for whatever reason, the big box establishments, who are the establishments who can pay us,
who have the money
on time, don't always pay us quickly.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's just finance department and all the people they other people they have to pay and getting you set up, because that's also the other thing, like all the clients that you have, the moment they have a signed contract or agreement, you ask them, how do I get paid? Like, what do you need from me? Let me send you all of my banking info, because they're, for whatever reason, getting you onboarded is always
takes a while. And I think that's why we've been, I feel like I have to knock on wood, we've been really good at getting paid within 30 days, because Robin starts that onboarding process as soon as the job is approved.
Yeah.
So by the time, well, also mainly to get our advance, because we need to have that advance before the shoot begins. I feel like at this point we don't spend out of pocket money. So we need that advance to start, and then that way we're already in the system and ready to bill as soon as we're done the job. And I do have to say, I have worked with other agents who are a little slow on the billing, and that could possibly be why it takes some people like longer than normal to get paid. I worked with one agent that we wrapped a job and it took her like a month to send in an invoice, and I was like, can you please, I need to get paid, because then once she sends in the invoice, then it's another month, you know. So it's really just depends on how prompt you are and if you have your systems in place.
That you just brought up a good point that I'm thinking about, where there's some scenarios where you sent in your invoice, but there's an XYZ person on the team and they want to run the payroll all at the same time, and so then they're waiting for that one person to send an invoice, and even though everybody else is done, they're just waiting on this one person. So that shoot that person.
I was just in a situation where I was doing payroll for the shoot, and I was waiting on the last invoice. Well, then I texted you and I was like, do I lose money if I run multiple payrolls? And you're like, oh no, it's fine. I was like, fine, whatever, I'm running everyone but this one person. But it's just nice and easy to do it all at once.
Yeah.
And so oftentimes people will wait until all the invoices are in. So basically, just send your invoices in right away, because we want to send you money.
Yeah. Well, not everyone.
You
know, I do have to say, if you ever come across a scenario where the company does have like a net 30 and 60 and 90 and you fought it all you can and they won't budge and you really want to do that job, you can try to work with whoever, you know, the creative director or whoever you're working with to ask them, you know, is there anything you can do to get that process moving quickly? I had a job that we didn't even shoot yet or talk about the shoot, and she was like, send your invoice.
Yeah.
She understood where I was coming from, even though she couldn't do anything to give me money faster. She was able to, you know, I think I got the check like actually like 3 weeks earlier than like, you know, whatever time. So
actually the same thing happened to me on the last cookbook that I did. The editor told me to do the same thing. She said, send me your advance and final right away, because she's like, it's going to take at least 30 days, if not more, to process it. So I just want to start working on everything. So I ended up getting paid everything all at once I mean, I didn't have the advance right away, but I had worked with them before, so I trusted them and it was fine. If the client that you're working with doesn't have a specified payment term in their contract that you have to sign, and you're sending in your contract that outlines a net 30, then there is nothing wrong with following up with that client on day 31.
Oh yeah.
Like, do not be insecure about bothering anyone. If they have agreed to your contract and they're a net 30, start following up. And what I usually do is, or back when I was handling all of this stuff myself, is I would set a reminder on day 31 for every single job. And if I hadn't been paid, I would send an email asking when I can expect this invoice to be fulfilled. Usually someone would respond. And then I would send a reminder for another week and a half to give them time. And then once that mark hit, I would write every like 3 days until someone paid me.
Yeah.
Because it's not okay.
Depending on what QuickBook, FreshBook, I'm assuming QuickBook probably does this too. FreshBooks automatically will send out emails and I can set it. I can say, send it the first day it's late, and then 3 days later, 5 days later, I can tell it every day if I wanted to.
Does FreshBooks charge a fee?
No. Yes. I mean, like a in
like
general.
A processing fee? Because I have QuickBooks and I don't invoice through them, and I don't know why.
I used to do invoicing separately, but it's just all streamlined in there. And I think in the very beginning, I was like, I cared about design, and actually the design for FreshBook looks pretty good, but I wanted it to be like all designy, and I'm like, I don't have time to be doing this every time. I love FreshBooks.
I mean,
Ren uses QuickBooks.
I have a love hate with QuickBooks, but yes.
I've also just been using FreshBooks for a really long time. So it's sort of just, you know, I used it for the very basic things, and then now they have a lot more features that I don't necessarily use all the time. But
yeah. All right. Great. What's next?
Editing and retouching. What do we do ourselves and what do we outsource?
I think because the budgets that we were working with in the beginning couldn't afford a retoucher and I wanted really good final images, I would end up doing most of my own retouching. For anything that was big that needed comping or anything like that, I would charge a retouching fee and then I would just do it because I wanted the extra cash. Now, I would just rather have a professional handle it.
Yeah.
If there's a retouching fee, we charge a post-processing fee, which means I am putting my personal look on it, but I'm not retouching anything.
My answer is the same. Ren. Did a lot of the stuff on my own and still, you know, depending on the job and what it's asking for, you know, I did something recently and the job, it was a little lower and the retouching to what I thought that they needed was pretty minimal minus a few people shots. So I actually sent the people shots to a retoucher that does a lot of people. And then I did all the food myself.
Nice. Yeah. And I feel like a lot of people ask how I edit.
Yes,
and
that's a question.
Oh, okay. Well, we could get back to that.
Well, no, that you can.
I do have one more thing to say about the postpart. I just got an email. It was basically about how do you keep the client from using your unedited images or low-res images before they're finished.
She asks, how do we get to a point where people understand previews are just that and they are unedited, low res, and not for use outside? Watermarking is going to be shut down, but what's the better way?
Yes.
And I think your response.
My very first advertising job that I had, they didn't have a retouching fee in our bid. They wanted to retouch in-house. So I assumed they would be editing all of the images in-house, including putting their own look on it, whatever. So we did this entire shoot and I didn't apply my look on it. And then the campaign came out and it was literally, they did nothing to the images. And I was so horrified because I was like, these look like nothing. Like, they don't look like me because I don't have me on them. I don't know. It was a whole thing. And there wasn't really anything I could do about it because they didn't want me to retouch or process or anything. They wanted to do it themselves. And so ever since that happened, I now always put a first pass process when I'm on set. And a lot of photographers don't do this. A lot of photographers will just shoot raw and send that off for selection or whatever. But I always have a first pass process on it because then if something gets lost in translation and those images do get published, then at least they have my look on them. Even though it's not perfect, it's still how I edit. But we always now charge a post-processing fee, and it's just about clear communication. I'm going to do a first pass process on set, and then when you send me the final list, I will fine-tune it and deliver those images. And there's a fee for that that we charge. The retoucher and I are in communication, so I can apply my look to it. I can get it to a place where I feel happy, and then they take over.
When you have a retoucher on your team, is it always your retoucher? Because so basically, yes. The scenario that I feel like I'm coming up with sometimes is like with some clients, they have an in-house retoucher or they already have a retoucher, and I'm never in communication with their retoucher because it's a separate thing. Like they have somebody that they work with, and so they kind of communicate with each other, which I mean, ultimately at the end of the day, it's like what the brand wants. And so they're able to, in theory, communicate that. But then, you know, sometimes I'm like you too. We sort of do like a first pass, but I've been trying to, when I can, to just push a retoucher on our side versus their side, so we can have that communication.
Yeah. I mean, if it is the retoucher on their side, and there's oftentimes, I mean, most times on big advertising jobs, the client walks with a drive and then it goes to either their retoucher or whatever. And in that case, there's not that much I can do about it. I don't want to give myself an insane amount of unnecessary work. So I just try to make it look as good as I can on set. And then it's up to them to finish the job. And hopefully they finish it nicely. But when I do have the option, like for example, there's certain clients where I know they don't have an in-house retoucher and they're maybe asking for a lot of images. So in that case, we've kind of come up with a system where we don't let them walk with a drive and we upload super, super low res images for them to select. And then they send me a final list and I finish it up for them and I make it look as nice as I can without a retoucher. And then the keyword for that is super low res so that they can't actually, it's like instead of watermarking, you send them something that can't appear full screen without it looking pixelated. It can't be printed because it's not print size. And so that's kind of the subconscious watermark that I put. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense. Even if they wanted to do stuff with it, or I don't know, some scenarios like some client will post some low res image and you're like, okay. I still feel like I have some of that. I'm like, why? Yeah, why? I like gave you like a high res file. Like, how did this happen?
Well, I actually know a photographer who sent unedited low res files to the publisher and then was just waiting for them to send a high res or to send them the final list. And then for whatever reason, who knows? I mean, it could have been the first cookbook, so maybe they didn't know any better, but they never got the list. They were just waiting for the list and didn't realize that the cookbook publisher had gone ahead with those low-res unedited files and sent them to print and printed the book.
Oh my gosh.
But I think there was some big chef attached to it, so it was actually a huge problem and they had to reprint, which was that's a huge fee that was lost.
Yeah, oh my gosh, that's crazy.
But after I heard that, I became super paranoid. And so again, I process everything very low res that you can't possibly have a designer see it and be like, oh, this will print just fine. And everything is labeled FPO, which in the publishing world, people know that means for placement only.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's just has to be a little extra communication so that the wrong thing doesn't actually get printed, because usually there's not anything you can do about it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times if you're not handling the retouching and they do it, it's just, you know, it is what
it is. Oh, we got a lot of questions on marketing and we did record an episode on it a year ago. Hopefully it's still up to date, but that'll maybe be out soon.
Someone asked about our lighting and editing process, which we kind of touched on. She asked if we bought presets or attended classes, buying courses. This was the question that I liked. What would you do now if you're trying to achieve a certain look, but we're coming to a dead end?
Oh my God, which actually happens to me. I think I just try really hard and then give up.
I mean, I think, you know, just trying to dissect photos and then doing it yourself. I think it's just like trial and error. I also feel like there's so many different ways to get to an end result that could look kind of similar too. But I think that's a great question. And I feel like when I saw this question, I kind of thought back about when I started shooting natural light and then when I started shooting strobes and what I did to achieve that look. And a lot of it was just trial and error, practicing a lot. I think if there's some scenario that I feel like I'm really in a rut, I have asked you, you know, ask a peer. I mean, I think it's a thing. You can't be like every shot, like, how did you get this shot? But maybe if there's something like you're trying to do and they can offer some feedback.
Yeah. It's like, how do I get darker shadows?
Flag it.
Build a cave. I feel like as far as editing goes, I think there's a lot you can find on YouTube. There's a lot of tutorials you can find on YouTube. There's certain looks that I'm like, oh, I wonder what my photo will look like if I edited like really muted or, you know, whatever. And then I find a YouTube tutorial and I just play around. And sometimes I like it and sometimes I don't. But it's, you know, it's kind of just trial and error. But I think if there's something that I'm really trying to achieve that's like a copy of someone, maybe unless they provide a preset.
Yeah, maybe it's not a copy, but maybe it's just like a look and feel, you know, like a vibe or something. Yeah. I don't know.
I guess I just, if I can't get there, I don't know if I would reach out and ask them, because I feel like editing is such a personal, it's a personal look. It's a personal style.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how to say exactly what I'm saying, but I've gotten questions before about how I edit. And I feel like the best answer to that is you really just play around with all the Capture One just has so many options. And I think it just has to do with playing around and finding what you love. And I think everyone reaches their look in a very different way, in a very different and personal way.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is just like once you edit a lot, you know, you have a look and feel. I mean, I guess sometimes too, the question you could ask be asking yourself is like, is this an editing thing or is it a lighting thing?
Yeah.
You know, right. I think when you were just saying to ask somebody, but yeah, I think it depends, you know,
it's and both.
I'm not going to go message somebody on Instagram that I don't know, but I think,
but
you know.
Some of those photographers that have really stylized looks do sell presets. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I've never bought them, but I don't think there's anything wrong with buying them.
I mean, you could buy presets. I think, you know, if you're shooting more lifestyle stuff, you could.
Yeah.
I think presets with food is a little
hard.
It doesn't, I think even if you buy a preset for lifestyle,
You still have to tweak it.
I don't know if that really answers her question.
First part of her question?
Just like if we bought presets, attend classes, or buying courses. I never did any of that stuff for editing. But I have taken classes on lighting.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Like a physical class or an online?
Physical class.
Oh, cool.
I took a class at Art Institute.
Oh, sweet.
That's before fun. I was only shooting natural. And that class, actually, we never really did much strobes. It was all just continuous light. They were basically just breaking down light. But I thought it would be fun to like learn something different.
I think classes are a really good investment. And there is only so much you can learn by yourself on your own.
I think you have to do.
Yeah, you have
to do. I
think
also it's like you can buy all the tutorials and look on YouTube and all that stuff, but really you have to do.
Do it, right.
You just have to practice. And then I think as you shoot more, you'll learn what works for you. But
also working on set is a really good way to learn. And if you don't have access to set, then taking classes is a great way to learn too.
Yeah. Let's see. Getting post-grad school, post-photography grad school. I think that was specifically her message. But I'm like, both of us didn't go to photography school.
Yeah. Well, I feel like if you went to photography school, then you probably learned how to work on set. And so I think, well, difference of opinion. I think you can start your own thing and also assist or tech or whatever to just build the network. But I do feel like some people kind of get stuck in the non-photo part because you obviously need to make a steady income. So I think it's kind of just making a conscious choice. It's like, okay, do I want to assist or work on set for 2 years and just learn as much as I can and meet as many people as I can? Or do I want to do my own thing and I will probably be very broke for a while. And if I need to, maybe I supplement it with set work or whatever. I don't
know. Shooting families.
Or weddings. Oh my gosh. You can make really good, consistent money shooting weddings. And then it frees up your weekday to take on other work. But I think because I knew so many people that went to photography school that went the assistant route, because I don't know if maybe that's what's taught in photo school. I just came across a fair amount of people that didn't want to be an assistant, but felt stuck as an assistant because of the security of it. I mean, you could say that about literally any job.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the people, whether you're self-taught or you're not self-taught, it's kind of just, again, taking that leap and being really intentional with the direction that you want to take and coming to terms with the fact that it's going to be not easy in the beginning. The way that I look at it is if you have two paths and you're like, should I work on set for 3 years or should I do my own thing for 3 years? I feel like by the time those 3 years are over, you'll maybe be at the point where you're like actually landing the clients that you want, whereas the assistant might feel like, okay, I'm actually ready to land the clients that I want. But then they don't have that 3 years of building your portfolio, business and portfolio behind. So I don't know. I think there's pros and cons to either.
I think it's a try to do simultaneous if you can. I mean, I think I would have liked to have more set experience, but just based on the natural progression of how I evolved into photography, it just never really happened for me. So
I think it's just being intentional. All right. Well, that was an amazing amount of questions. I don't think we got to all of it. So maybe we'll do a part two.
And there's some questions on there that we already have lined up for future episodes.
Yes.
So those will be coming soon.
Okay, I'm going to stop recording. Thanks.
Yes. Bye. If you have any comments, questions, or ideas on future episodes, email us at photodump.club@gmail.com.
Photo Dump was created by Ren Fuller and Jennifer Chong. Thank you to Sam Fuller for our cover art and overall tech support. Our music was created by Daniel Smith.
You can find me on Instagram at jchongstudio.
And me at Ren_Fuller.
Thanks for listening.